Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. In the wake of civil rights lawsuits filed by families of individuals with mental illness who were killed by police officers, there's a growing push for crisis intervention training, or CIT, known as the Memphis Model. CITs were developed in Memphis, Tennessee, after an officer killed a mentally ill person in 1987. Today, there are more than 2,800 CIT programs in at least 45 states. The programs are designed to provide safety for police officers, safety for family members, and safety for those suffering from a mental illness crisis. Tracy Small is the coordinator of Crisis Intervention Team for the Center Region. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
What exactly is crisis intervention training? I know it originated in Memphis, Tennessee in 1988, but what is it?
It's a training that we provide locally here for our dispatchers, for our police officers, EMTs, corrections officers, probation officers, and anyone who's likely to have a first point of contact with someone who's suffering from a mental health crisis. It's important that we provide those individuals with training so they know what's going on with that person and the resources that we have in our community that they can divert them to and help keep them away from the criminal justice system.
The reality is entanglements between those with mental illness and law enforcement is on the rise.
It is, yes.
Typically, what sorts of things bring the mentally ill to the attention of police officers or first responders in the first place?
It could be anything. It could be that the person is having their first mental health break. We see that a lot with college students. That's a big population, of course, as we know around here. It could be a student that's just feeling overwhelmed and anxious from being away from home. They may feel like it's too much for them and they become suicidal. It could be a situation where someone's in a car accident and they may not have a mental health issue, but that situation is significant enough that it triggers something and they become more upset and more anxious. If it's someone who is experiencing psychosis, they might be hearing voices. And that's a big part of what we do in our training. We have an activity that's actually 3 hours long where we have everyone in the class go through this experiment of what it's like to actually hear voices. So a lot of times it's fear. It's a lot of the emotions and the behaviors that bring that to the attention of law enforcement and first responders.
To what extent are problems like bipolar or schizophrenia compounded by drug abuse?
Well, that's something we also talk about is substance abuse and co-occurring disorders, because the two very much go hand in hand. A lot of people will self-medicate instead of seeking help. That's just a coping skill that they have. So you do oftentimes see people who have mental health issues that are also using drugs or alcohol. If they're hearing voices, they might use drugs and alcohol to drown out those voices. So it is something that we do see pretty frequently.
It makes it pretty tricky, though, because if a police officer is responding to someone who's acting out and then compounded with that, obviously they're under the influence, mm-hmm. and the goal is to decriminalize this, to divert them from going to jail. Mm-hmm. How do you do that? Who ought to go to jail, mm-hmm. and who ought to be referred for mental health counseling?
Right. We always tell people if they're committing a crime and it's a definite crime, then we don't expect them to do anything differently. And, you know, if they need to take someone to jail or arrest them, then that's what they need to do. With the substance abuse part of it, what oftentimes will happen is the officer will get the person to the hospital and then they will have to detox to a 0.08 before the hospital will even evaluate them for mental health issues. So it kind of gives them that opportunity to see, are these behaviors something that are subsiding as they're detoxing, or are the behaviors still there? And that can oftentimes be the key between, you know, yes, this is a mental health thing versus maybe that was just them being under the influence. So then, you know, we kind of take it to the next step, whatever that would be then.
And the key to that, from what I'm reading, is going out into the field with a plan. And you can't go out into the field with a plan unless you've been trained. Law enforcement officers have been trained to use deadly force, but what percentage of them receive the kind of training that's necessary to deal with people in mental crisis situations in the police academy, for example?
Mm-hmm. Well, that is something that I know that the state of Pennsylvania is looking at. MOPAC, which is the Municipal Police Officers Training Academy, is looking at integrating this into their training at the academy level because they're recognizing that this is an important piece noticed that officers more and more are dealing with situations of people who are in crisis and can't handle those situations. So it's important that we introduce that, at least in the academy. And then a big part of our CIT program is it's a resource-driven program. So, for example, our resources that we have in Center County are much different than in the surrounding counties. So it's important.
Why? Because the population here is different. There's a large student population.
That's part of it. Yes. Yeah. Just the resources that we may have. We may have more case management services here than other places do. Our mental health treatment facility might be different than, say, another county. It's kind of county specific. Whenever officers get trained in the academy and then they go to wherever they're going to be, it's important for them to know the resources that they have in that community available to that person who's in a crisis.
And your job really is to coordinate with what is available.
Right. Right. To be in touch with, you know, a lot of the resources that we have in the community and to find out from our officers also what's going on out there. You know, what are they seeing? For example, a couple years ago, synthetic marijuana and bath salts were something that officers were dealing with quite a bit. So we were able to provide more training for officers on, you know, how symptoms and side effects of those can sometimes mimic somebody who's really truly experiencing a mental health crisis, the psychosis. So we're able to provide them with that type of training then that's specific to what they're seeing out in the field.
There seem to be two schools of thought about who ought to be trained. One is that everyone ought to be trained. Mm-hmm. And the other school of thought is what we really need is at least one specialist on the scene who will take charge in a situation that's dealing with a mental illness. Mm-hmm. So 24/7, we need someone who can respond, but not everybody needs to be trained. What's your feeling on that?
Well, I think it's important for every officer to have a basic understanding of mental health issues. And the Memphis model does say that, you know, the training should be on a voluntary basis. It should be people who want to go out and take that extra step to help. And that was our goal when we started CIT 5 years ago, was to have a certain percentage of our police departments trained so that on every shift, there would be at least one officer in each department that would be trained. So if there was a call that came through to dispatch and dispatch was able to recognize this as a mental health call, they have a whole list of all the officers that have been CIT trained that they can dispatch that officer if they're available to that call to respond.
Your husband is a State College Borough police officer, mm-hmm. and he was actually one of the first in the county to receive CIT training. Mm-hmm. And I understand that you said to him, this is what I've been trying to get you guys to sign up for, because you knew that it was an important program. You ended up leading the program. So I'm curious to know a little bit about your background, how you came to conduct the training, and in general across the country, who is doing the training?
Well, my background is actually in psychology, and I worked for many years in a mental health residential facility, which basically was a transition between individuals mostly leaving the state hospitals and weren't quite ready for independent living. They needed that extra support in there. And sometimes we had to call on police if we had a situation that involved a weapon or someone was barricaded in their room. We didn't want to just enter. So we did need to call police, and that is when I said to my husband probably like 15 years ago, when people move out of our program and they do live on their own, when they're having a hard time, they're going to be calling 911. So why wouldn't we take the time to train first responders on more issues on mental illness and resources that we have out there so you're better prepared to handle these situations? Nationally, well, I can tell you from Pennsylvania, I think we're the only county, the only CIT program who has a specific CIT coordinator designed to put together these trainings and provide the outreach that we do. Nationwide, it's kind of a combination, I think, of first responders who are interested in this, as well as individuals who work in behavioral health. NAMI has a big role in this.
You're talking about the National Alliance on Mental Illness.
Yes.
Which
yes.
is probably the leader in advocating for this kind of training.
Absolutely. And they're a big part of our training. We have families who come in who are part of our local NAMI chapter, and they speak about what their experiences are like day in and day out to live with someone with a mental illness.
And their experience often is that our prisons and jails are becoming de facto mental health care facilities.
Right.
According to some statistics, half of those people who are incarcerated in the U.S. right now suffer from some form of a mental illness.
Yes.
The idea that they're trying to advocate is that mental illness is not a crime.
Right. And that's the whole point of the training, is to divert someone away from the criminal justice system for, you know, maybe it's the behaviors that they're exhibiting that can lead them to commit a crime, a small crime. Maybe it's, you know, shoplifting or something like that. You know, maybe they're hungry and they, you know, taking a bag of chips or something.
Or maybe they're just acting out.
Exactly. It could be their behaviors. It could be anything. So, you know, it's really important that we provide it to everyone across the board. Any first responder, corrections officers, obviously, because like you said, they're just seeing that more and more.
I want to talk a little bit about the training. I know it's 40 hours, week-long crisis intervention training. Exactly what does it entail?
Well, one of the great things about the training is that it is flexible. So there are core elements that the Memphis model says we need to provide. And then the rest of the training is resources and special populations. So our training, you know, we start out Monday morning and we give everyone the lowdown on mental illness. You know, we talk about bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, the side effects of medication. And we talk about specialized populations like our military servicemen and women who are coming home and suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder.
And in fact, you're dedicating an entire day of that 40
almost.
Hours
to
dealing with the veteran population.
Yes, almost. So it's just learning a lot about the medications that people might be taking. One of the big things is getting out into the community and doing site visits. So actually visiting, the place where I used to work is one of the places that we visit, the residential program, and also a day program that we have in this area called Clubhouse. And that opportunity then for police officers that are in the training and first responders, when they're out of uniform, to be able to interact with individuals who have mental health issues, and for them to be able to come together and break down those barriers and the stigma that's, I think, on both sides. You know, there's the mental health stigma and the law enforcement stigma. And this really gives them the opportunity, you know, for police officers to ask, well, what can I do best when you're experiencing a crisis? Let's talk about this now while you're not experiencing a crisis and you're in a good frame of mind. You know, it gives people with mental health issues the opportunity to talk to law enforcement to say, you know, when I'm thrown in the back of a car with handcuffs, I can't help but think that that's because of my mental illness. So if you take that extra time and just explain that that's part of your policy, then that's going to help de-escalate that situation.
You're sort of hitting on something that's a crucial part of this, and that is one of the common denominators in any of the situations you've described is fear.
Mm-hmm.
Fear on the part of the person with mental illness, fear on the part of the family member who may have called and said, my son or my daughter or my husband is acting out, mm-hmm. and he's quit taking his meds. And then, of course, fear on the part of the police officer.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things you advise them in your training to do is talk to this person and address them by name.
Yes.
Why is that so important?
I think it's important for everybody. I mean, who doesn't like to say, you know, have their name? That helps reassure that person that they're being heard, that when that officer is interacting with them and they use their name, that can actually de-escalate that situation a little bit for that officer, and they're able to engage with that person further. It really does worlds of wonder. And the other thing that we've heard people say is a smile. You know, a smile can go a long way. So that's an important thing, too. Being aware of their stance. You know, a lot of times I think with law enforcement, they have a tendency to, you know, they wear their duty belt and they've got all these things on there and it's kind of hard for them to stand, you know, a certain way. But one of the things that we've heard repeatedly is when officers are standing with their hand, you know, arm resting on their weapon or their hand, that can actually trigger some further emotions with the person who's in crisis and make them more fearful. So just being aware of those little things, you know, and we talk about those things in the training that are so important, those little things.
You might have someone who say, yes, but I've got my hand on my hip and right near my gun holster because I don't know. These can be such dangerous and unpredictable situations.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, they definitely can be. And that's one of the things that we stress, that we always stress in every training, is officer safety is paramount. We will never ask an officer to disregard any other training that he or she has had. And, you know, to keep their stance, they have, you know, a safety area that they need to keep between themselves and their subject. And we understand that. We would never ask an officer to change that. But being able to communicate is one of those tools that they don't necessarily carry on their tool belt that they they've had training for. So this is their 40-hour training to learn how to be more effective with communication, listening skills.
And that's being more empathic.
It is. It is.
Listening and summarizing what's wrong.
Right. And reflecting, you know, how that person's feeling and validating their feelings. And that's a lot of times all that the person needs. You know, 50% of the calls that the officers are responding to, they're able to de-escalate that situation on the scene and they don't need any further intervention. So it's a good thing.
If you're just joining us, this is Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia, and our guest is Tracy Small, Coordinator of Crisis Intervention Team, or CIT, for the Center Region. Her job is to bring law enforcement together with mental health providers in a way that decriminalizes mental health and de-escalates potentially dangerous situations. Part of your job is also coordinating, as you said, with local crisis agencies, so you're able to make appropriate referrals. I'm wondering, because this is such an enormous problem nationwide, is there adequate mental health available to meet the demand?
Unfortunately, in my opinion, I don't think that there is. You know, we see that reduction in the number of state hospital beds, and in order for that to be successful, we have to have community supports in place and community programs that are going to be helpful for people that are coming out of the state hospitals or coming out of jails or prisons who have a mental health disorder. So I think it is a problem. And for example, we just had our training 2 weeks ago, and we heard from CAPS, which is the Counseling and Psychological Services on campus.
At Penn State,
they used to be able to offer 10 free sessions to anyone who came in. And then if they needed more support, they would outsource that person. Then they would help refer them to other community resources. Well, now what we're hearing is that there's such a backlog that they're only able to provide 2 sessions before they have to do that. And they have a waiting list of like upwards of 200 people waiting to get in the door. So it is a problem. We also have our mobile crisis locally, Can Help, which responds to people over the phone. They can go out and meet with people in the community. And I know that they are always hopping because there's such an increase in the number of people with mental health issues. They're always busy.
You mentioned Penn State campus, and in fact, at Penn State, they're actually training resident assistants. There are 277 RAs who are trained before each semester with mental health awareness. So when a student in crisis who's suffering from anxiety to depression to relationship problems, they can seek out an RA who has some training in dealing with them.
Yes, and I think that's wonderful. And actually, that's the first I've really heard that that is happening. And, you know, that first point of contact is so important because that person can be the catalyst that helps get the person who's in crisis to the appropriate treatment. I'm glad to hear that that is happening on campus.
Yeah, they're doing something very similar to what you're doing. They actually have play acting scenarios with actors.
Mm-hmm.
To help them work in what will feel like a real-life situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You do that as well. Explain.
We do.
Explain what you do.
We do. At the end of our training week, you know, after we've packed everybody full of all this information on mental illness and they've met with families and they've met with people who have mental illness and they're learning all this stuff, we say, you know, now we need to put it to use. Now we need to make it practical. So we have scenarios at the end of the week where we do have officers come up. The scenarios that we provide them are based on actual 911 calls that we've gotten right here in the Center Region. Nothing is made up. Oftentimes, you know, it will be a call that maybe someone who's in the training has helped another officer respond to, and they'll say, you know, I was on that call and that seemed very real. But we have them come up and we go through actual scenarios that they may deal with. And we give feedback after they're done with their scenario to kind of help them, you know, this was really good, but maybe next time just, you know, maybe you want to try this. This is what's worked for me. And these are all officers who sit on the panel to give feedback who have been CIT trained and have been able to go out and use their skills and apply them and see that they do work.
And some say what we really need in situations like this is muscle memory. You need to do this training often enough so that it's an automatic response.
Mm-hmm.
My first response is, Joe, tell me what's going on. If you don't do that enough, you're not going to do it automatically when you need to.
Right. Right. And we've actually had officers who have gone through the training and they're up, you know, doing their scenario. And then they have probably not too long after they go through the training, they have their first mental health call where maybe someone is experiencing some psychosis. And what we've heard is a lot of times the officers will kind of pause and look around like they feel like they're back in the training. Like, this is, you know, I'm waiting to kind of be critiqued because that's what happened in training. So it just does kind of come naturally to them. But yeah, the muscle memory thing, I think the more they use it, the better they become and the more comfortable they become. And we want them to be able to do that in the training, in the classroom, so that when they get out there, that they do feel comfortable and confident using those skills.
The sad reality is too often people with mental illness end up in prison or jail. Mm-hmm. And experts in this say that's the absolute worst place for them to be. Mm-hmm. Number one, they end up serving more time because of their mental illness, and they are more likely to be the victims of serious crime, rape and solitary confinement and all kinds of things while they're confined, while of course not addressing their underlying problem.
Right. Right. And I can tell you, on a local level, our county jail is really doing some wonderful things. And they are such a supporter of our CIT program. They've had lots of their COs, corrections officers, who have come through the training and understand that, you know, this is really important because they do have such a large population that it's important that they're able to de-escalate that situation. And they're sort of in a different role than law enforcement is, because law enforcement makes that initial contact and then they move the person on to wherever they're going. With someone who's in jail, they're in jail. The corrections officers have that person in there ongoing, so they get to know that person, and it's an opportunity for them to build rapport. Like I said, you know, I know the jails are really trying to build a good package around someone who's leaving with mental health disorders, to make sure that they have medication when they leave, to make sure that their housing needs are being met so they're not ending up on the streets. The whole part of CIT, the team part of it, I think is sometimes a misconception that, you know, it's kind of like a SWAT team that responds. The team part of it is all of us working together and coming up with a plan to help support these individuals who are in crisis and volatile situations.
How supportive is the local mental health community in helping you do your job? And I ask that because I know nationwide, in some places, there's conflict and tension between law enforcement and mental health providers.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, you know, if you would have asked me that 5 or 10 years ago, I would have said, you know, yes, there's definitely that barrier, that wall between law enforcement and mental health. And I think a big part of what CIT has been able to do is break down those barriers and break down those walls, and allows us to have more communication between, you know, what's going on with first responders and what's going on with mental health. And it's bringing them together quite well in our area.
Speaking of first responders, the first contact with police in situations is absolutely critical. So I'm wondering, what is the role of dispatchers? We all have all heard the news story where police got a call that there was someone in a park with a gun, mm-hmm. but the dispatcher failed to say that the caller said it's probably a toy gun, mm-hmm. and this child was shot within seconds,
right.
Shot dead within mm-hmm. seconds.
Yeah, it's a hard call for police to make, obviously. You know, if they're in a situation, they have to observe everything around them and make split decisions. But the role with dispatch, and what we really, you know, want them to focus on, is asking more questions when they're on the phone. A lot of times it might come through as a health and safety call that the officer is dispatched to, whereas if we train our dispatchers to ask a few more questions, they're going to be able to provide that law enforcement officer or an EMT with more information. And they're able to kind of flag certain addresses of individuals who maybe want them to be tagged that address. So whenever officers respond to that, they know that they're going out to a mental health, or they could be going out to a mental health related call. And they do have a list of all of our trained officers that they can dispatch. But it's really being able to ask a few more questions when they're on the phone with that person, or it could be someone who's calling because they're observing someone in the community who's displaying some, you know, odd behaviors, and someone calls because they're concerned. So that dispatcher asking a few more questions to those individuals is definitely a critical part of the response of that officer.
To date, you have trained 226 police officers since the program began in the Center Region in 2011. Mm-hmm. How are police officers responding to it? Are they feeling more confident when they go out into the field?
I think that they are. I think sometimes, you know, we have people that come to the training that aren't quite sure about, you know, what their 40 hours is going to look like. So they're maybe a little hesitant to be at the training. And by the end of the week, a lot of those people are coming up and they're saying, this is really the best training that we've had. And as far as, you know, boots on the ground, this is what we need to know. These are the basics. And now we can apply them because we've done these scenarios.
Yeah, in fact, I've talked with officers who say, as you said, it's the best thing they've done. They feel more confident about their role. The National Alliance on Mental Illness says that this is much more cost-effective, too, than sending someone to prison. It's $31,000 on average per year to incarcerate someone with a mental illness, $10,000 per year to treat them with community mental health services.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and that makes sense. I mean, that's part of the reason why we're doing it. You know, we don't want to criminalize a mental illness. And that, unfortunately, is what's happened across, you know, our nation, is that mental illness has become criminalized and there's that stigma. So certainly if that first point of intercept with someone, if that officer is able to divert them to treatment, you know, get them to the hospital, maybe they need to be involuntarily committed, that the person's not able to see that, you know, that they're very much a danger to themselves or someone else, that is diverting them away and helping them get that first foot in the door towards getting help, as opposed to criminalizing it and getting them to jail. Because a lot of people, you know, they have a mental illness, a lot of people can't afford the court costs and the fines and, you know, everything that goes along with the criminal side of the law. So
there are also, though, consequences if someone is 302'd, if police send them to the hospital sends a person to a local mental health care facility. That's something that can also have long-term consequences. So this is not an easy situation all the way around.
Right. You know, we always encourage our officers to take the least restrictive means. And part of being on the scene with that person is trying to sometimes convince them that they do need help and that they really want to get them to the hospital to have treatment. And, you know, a lot of times what we see is that person then will be like, okay, you know, I do need this help. And they will be able to go in on a voluntary basis. And that can be that, again, that foot in the door. We want to go for the least restrictive means, but sometimes, you know, we can't do that, and it is necessarily to involuntarily commit someone.
CAIT, crisis intervention training, is called a best practice, and some call it a promising practice, but it's not yet an evidence-based practice. Mm-hmm. So I'm just wondering, how confident are you in the ability for this to work, and where do you see it going? As I said, over 2,800 communities across the country are now training their police officers.
Well, I know, you know, from a statewide perspective, it's definitely growing. When I first started this job 5 years ago, there were just a handful of communities that were actively involved, you know, with CIT training. And now it's close to, I think, half of the counties in Pennsylvania that are adopting this training program because they see that it is working. It's helping to divert people. And, you know, one of the things that it's kind of hard to prove, but when you have someone, say, who's suicidal, and you have a police officer who intervenes, and they might be the person who actually helps save that person's life, it gets kind of tricky because you can't really track, you know, it's kind of like proving a false negative because you can't really say, you know, that it is working in that way, because we don't ever know how many lives these first responders are actually saving by being able to communicate with that person and de-escalate them and get them the help they need.
How is it being funded?
We are currently receiving a grant through Pennsylvania Commission on Crimes and Delinquency. So we actually we're wrapping up our second year of the grant funding, and then we are going to be looking for ways to sustain it because we've seen that it has helped and that, you know, people are wanting this training. I already have probably 6 or 7 people on the waiting list for our next training, and we haven't even announced the dates yet. We don't even know when it's going to be. So it's definitely something that says to me that, you know, people want this. It's working, and they want to see more of it.
All right. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
That was Tracy Small, coordinator of Crisis Intervention Team, or CIT, for the Center Region. To date, Small has trained 226 police officers and first responders since January 2011. To learn more about the so-called Memphis model, check the links on our website, wpsu.org/take note. I'm Patty Satalia, WPSU.